You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 12th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Exploding Whale Day, everybody.
Whoa.
Exploding? Oh, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Remember that?
What the hell is that?
In 1970, the Oregon Highway Division attempts to destroy a rotting beached sperm whale with explosives, leading to the infamous exploding whale incident. So look it up. It's on the internet.
There's video.
I haven't seen it in a long time. So you got this carcass on the beach, and they don't know what to do with it. So there's a news report going on during the time, and the highway division is out there. They're stuffing the thing with dynamite all around it, and then they take footage of it, and that thing blows up. It spreads the carcass in like a half mile radius. It was raining down all over people. It crushed cars.
Oops.
It was a disaster, and it only got rid of about, you know, 2/3 of the carcass. They still had to bulldoze the rest of it away.
Yeah, it was a whale of a cleanup.
So to celebrate, we at the SGU here are carving into a Fudgy the Whale Carvel ice cream cake and serving it up in large chunks. So
Fudgy the Whale.
Remember that?
Fudgy the Whale. They had one mold for everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Fudgy the Whale was Santa Claus and also that stupid elf thing they had.
Cookie Puss.
I remember that.
There was a girl on my roller derby team named Cookie Puss.
Well, there's probably a story there.
That's all I have to offer. Yes.
You got pictures? What happened?
We have a lot of news items to get to, so let's get started. We also have an interview coming up later in the show with Paul Offit, who's the author of Autism's False Prophets. But first, some news. A new study looks at the role of so-called junk DNA.
Yeah. Yeah, this is pretty cool. For decades now, we've known that the 3 billion base pairs that make up human DNA contain vast wastelands of genetic code that do not code for proteins. No function could be found for much of this apparent useless 97% or so of our genome. In 1972, late geneticist Susumu Ono coined the term junk DNA. Over the years, there's been lots of theories have been proposed and tantalizing clues have been revealed that show much of this dark matter of the genome is not junk at all. And most recently, Genome Research published an article from scientists at the Genome Institute of Singapore, and they claim that much of this so-called junk DNA is not only useful, it's one of the key ingredients that distinguishes people from other animals. In their paper, these scientists describe how these long stretches of repeated base pairs in our DNA are important for determining which genes turn on, when they turn on, and how much they turn on. And they also show that these repeats can jump around the genome, changing how genes are expressed, which could obviously then change the course of evolution for the species that it's happening in.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with junk DNA is that it's ultimately like a vestigial organ. It's kind of an argument from ignorance. Like, we can't find any use for this. It's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to prove that it's serving no use, right? So, I mean, it's not surprising that over time that we would slowly start to find that, you know, the non-coding regions, the parts of the DNA that are not genes, not coding for proteins, as you say, are serving some role. And it's, you know, doubly not surprising that it's serving a regulatory role. But as you imply, the regulatory regions of the genome have a huge effect on the final, you know, morphology, you know, development of the individual. You think of it, you know, how much more of an effect you have on a creature by turning off a gene or turning on a gene as opposed to just changing one little piece of the gene, right?
Yeah.
That's why, you know, with such little tweaks to these regulatory parts of the genome can have vast, you know, implications or effects on the ultimate development of the organism. So, although this new research is very interesting, it's not an entirely new concept that there's regulatory roles occurring in these previously so-called junk DNA regions.
What I found interesting especially was the fact that people always say, well, hey, this experiment worked on the mice. Why doesn't it work on the people? And mice and monkeys, I mean, the complement of genes and proteins that they have are nearly identical to us. So why is this, this huge difference in their response to some of these experiments? And this explains some of that because they've got these regulatory genes or areas of their genome are in different areas, and they might be doubled or tripled up more than ours. And that explains a lot of why there's such a huge difference in between animals and between animals and us.
Now, this does not mean that there still isn't non-coding sequences in the DNA that are not currently serving any function.
Correct.
There probably still is some junk in there. It's just not as much as, you know, we're starting from the point of maximal ignorance. The number can always go down, but it's not zero.
Right.
So, you know, to be entirely clear, there is still plenty of junk DNA in our DNA. This doesn't mean that there's no junk DNA. And also, some of the article kind of, I think, overstated it a little bit, saying that because the junk DNA provides raw material for evolutionary changes, it's not junk. But actually, that's, I think, the wrong way of looking at it. It's because it's not currently coding for anything or serving a purpose that a lot of this junk DNA is raw material for later evolution. One thing I found really interesting, Bob, was that you know, over time, viruses insert their genes or their code into the DNA of animals, and then sometimes they get stuck in there. Or while the virus's DNA is in the host's DNA, a mutation occurs which inactivates the virus. So then you have this inactivated viral DNA sort of stuck in the genome of the host. And this is actually one of the ways in which we can map out the relatedness among species. It's actually a very powerful source of evidence for common descent. But what's really interesting is that even these viral bits of DNA that were inserted into the genome may at some point in the future start to take on a purpose, because they continue to mutate, and they may just hit upon some sequence that then becomes useful to the host.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Who knows what can be used in the future?
Anything, any sequences in the DNA can serve as raw material for mutations and natural selection and can do stuff. So it may actually, some DNA may be junk at one point in time, but then be recovered just by random chance.
And who knows, in the future of certain species, there could be some latent ability that just requires one or two little mutations, and then bam, they could have a whole new abilities or anatomical structure or something. Right. Who knows?
Yeah, in fact, it just becomes a way of increasing the novel content in the genome. Again, this serves as more raw material. But of course, this doesn't stop the creationists from using this as a false argument against evolution or the evidence for evolution.
Yeah, scientists show that junk DNA have a purpose, and they, of course, will say, well, yes, of course, God does not make junk.
Right.
So I've seen that already.
So very, very interesting research.
And more than that, though, Steve, Raymond White from the University of California said that the findings from this study are very exciting, and he said that they represent what may be one of the major discoveries in the biology of evolution and gene regulation of the decade. So it's fairly significant.
Absolutely, although there's always a tendency to sort of overinterpret the impact of new research. But it's hard. We'll see. We'll see 10 years from now if that's still true. But it is a very significant breakthrough. I agree with that. Another interesting news item, which I actually blogged about last week, having to do with backyard nuclear reactors. Now, have you guys heard of this?
This is awesome.
It's unbelievable, actually.
Yeah. I mean, when I first saw that, I'm like, wow, that's. I almost didn't believe it. I was like, well, that's really odd. I mean, that you could miniaturize it to that degree. So this is a New Mexico company called Hyperion, which is in the process of mass producing and marketing a micro nuclear reactor. This is a nuclear reactor that is about 10 feet or 3 meters in diameter, and that's it. It's the kind of thing that you could bury in your backyard.
Absolutely.
Although, the power output is more than you would need for a single home. I mean, this is the kind of thing that can run, say, a neighborhood, say 20,000 homes.
20,000 homes or a military establishment or
a city block.
But how do you replenish the fuel, and how do you clean it out?
Well, you don't do anything, Jay. You get this thing factory sealed. They bury it. It's encased in concrete. And 7 to 10 years, they'd have to actually, this was a little disappointing for me, but every 7 to 10 years, they actually have to dig it up, bring it back, and refuel it. Mm-hmm. But and they don't tell you, you know, what does it cost? Do you have to pay another $25 million to get it back, or what's the servicing? They don't go into any details about that, but it is.
They probably don't know that yet.
I'm sure they would have given some thought to that.
The price range might be too broad to make any kind of definitive statement on that at this point.
But if you amortize the cost, okay, it costs $25 million, right, is the price that they're anticipating for this. Toshiba actually, several years ago, came out with their own design for the mini nuclear reactor. And they're supposed to be coming on the market like in 2009, even sooner than the New Mexico company.
Yeah, theirs is a little less, is less power, but they're designing theirs. One of them was designed, like, say, to run a big building for 40 years. That's pretty cool.
That'd be nice. Yeah, 40 years, you got your juice.
But $25 million, I mean, what would the circumstance be? I mean, I know this is very nearsighted of me, but give me a circumstance where it would be worthwhile to spend that money to power a building. Where in the middle of nowhere? Like what?
Well, certainly, yeah, it's for locations which are remote from the grid. It would be hard to send wires up there. For poor countries that don't have the infrastructure. You know, this doesn't require an infrastructure. There it is, and you could run.
But if they're poor, who's got the 25 mil?
But that's still a lot less than having to put up a power grid in your country.
Definitely.
And Jay, if you own a building, if you own, you know, a $50 million building or more, or, God, what does a big building cost these days? I don't even know. You could spend hundreds of millions or billions of dollars.
A sports stadium costs $1 billion to build these
$25 million, you know, isn't that much. And think about, you're going to be paying for energy anyway. I mean, it's not like this is an extra cost.
Yeah, and if you spread out the cost, it comes down to somewhere between around half the cost of grid electricity. So it's actually cost effective.
And I imagine if you produce a surplus of electricity, you could probably sell some of that back to the electric company even.
Yeah.
Maybe. Now,
it's true.
For me, what's the big glowing radioactive elephant in the room right now? It's how safe is this? Isn't that one of the first things you think? How safe is this thing? And to me, it seems like they gave some thought to this. According to their website, it's impossible, this is Hyperion's website, it's impossible for the module to go supercritical, melt down, or create any type of emergency situation. It seems like quite a broad statement, but it's designed not to go supercritical. There's no moving parts.
And to clarify that, this is not the same kind of process that's going on in a big nuclear power plant with rods and a reaction the way it's happening there. This is a completely different process with different elements, et cetera, that is cannot go critical, cannot melt down.
It will
run very, very hot. And in fact, they say the fact that it runs so hot is an advantage because then it becomes difficult to tamper with. You know, not only would you have to dig down to it and break into its, you know, concrete case, then when you get into it, you have this red hot glowing chunk of metal that make it very difficult
approach, right?
Yeah, but you physically can't do anything with. And you know, obviously, you always think of terrorism and vandalism. You know, what terrorists get a hold of the material in there, you can make a dirty bomb out of it, or just exposing it to the outside. But you know, I mean, what if we have hundreds or thousands of these things spread around the country?
Right.
What would the vulnerability of that create? You know, the fact that they're buried underground obviously is a good
in concrete
is a good security measure. And you would think, you know, it'd be kind of difficult to break into them. So if they were in a conspicuous location where it would be difficult to go unnoticed while you're, you know, digging into the ground, and
yeah, I mean, even a satellite would be able to determine what you're doing.
So I think security would be. Sounds manageable. And
well, not only that, they recommend, and I think they would provide possibly, but they said that it would be guarded by a security detail. So wherever they sell these, there will be security there. I wonder if they're extra.
Well, that would incur an extra cost.
And even, Steve, even if somehow you crack this thing open on site, the fuel would just immediately cool. It's not like you're going to have this huge radiation leak. And the uranium itself is not designed for weapons. Hyperion's CEO said that you would need nation-state resources in order to enrich our uranium. And even the waste, how about the waste? What kind of waste does this thing produce? And even that seems manageable. After 5 years, the waste will be, they compare it to the size of a softball. Granted that would be one nasty softball, but apparently it can be recycled without much of a problem. So
yeah.
Well, is there anything bad about this thing?
I mean, it obviously, we brought up the security risk is the big thing, but that seems manageable. Like all nuclear sources of power, there's going to be some waste issues, but as the technology improves, that's less and less of an issue.
Yeah, I got a downside.
What?
This is actually late breaking news on this. As usual, it looks like it's going to be delayed. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, contacted the website that I got some of this information from, and they said that the NRC has no plans to review the Hyperion design in the near future. It turns out that the commission had talks with Hyperion, but they were just preliminary talks, and it might not happen quite as fast as we might hope.
Mm-hmm.
Hyperion Power Generation indicated that they'll submit technical reports to support a pre-application review in late fiscal year 2009. So I don't know if they're going to make their 2012-2013 deadline, but hopefully the delay won't be too extensive.
Well, and that's just the United States. I mean, another country could open it up for them, and they could do their preliminary. Yeah.
Well, again, Toshiba's already has their own designs for a very similar thing.
Yeah, so yeah, I think what Hyperion did is their design is a little bit – there's a lot of new stuff in it because, I mean, the design was hashed out 50 years ago. So it's not like this is a completely new thing that, it's a new type of reactor. No, the design for this type of nuclear battery was hashed out a long time ago, 50 years ago. It seems to me that they're a little bit, they made some changes to it, and it's a little different from the Toshiba, and it's...
Well, this thing is like right out of a comic book, you know? Like I could...
It really is.
It totally spins my science fiction wheels, you know? I'm just thinking of all the different places in science fiction where this could be used, like, you know, from Batman's lair all the way to, like, you know, I thought...
This is what I'm thinking. This is what I thought. All right, when I win the lotto or Mega Millions in a few years and I got, like, $50 million, and I will, of course, set up our last refuge. If the world goes to hell, we're all gonna converge on this little... place, not little, this big place that I'm going to build that'll be partially underground, and I'm going to have two or three of these babies sitting under there. Now, if it could do a 20,000 home community for 5 to 10 years, and I figured it could do this place for probably 100 years, get a couple of these, and we're all set. We don't have to worry about pure water. We don't have to worry about electricity. We'll even have a force field this thing will create. We'll be all set. No zombies are going to get to us.
That's right. But there are a lot of practical
Good point,
advantages
Bob.
For this kind of approach, meaning a disseminated or a decentralized power generation. Actually having huge power generators or factories in remote locations and then shipping or conducting the electricity to where it's being used is very, very wasteful. The only reason why we went with this design 50 or 100 years ago was because the forms of power generation were polluting, and we didn't want to have coal, power plants in the middle of cities. But this kind of self-contained, mini nuclear reactor is one way to have the power generation right where it's being used. Therefore, you save on the inefficiency of transporting the electricity at high voltage through power lines. You also another advantage to local generation of power is that any waste heat that's generated could actually be used to heat water or to heat buildings.
Right.
So if you think about it this way, if you have a remote power plant, the heat just gets vented and just gets wasted to the environment. You then transport the electricity to a remote location where you then use it to make heat. I mean, right?
It's pretty
as opposed to just using the heat that's generated in the process of making the electricity. So there's a double efficiency gain with this kind of disseminated power generation that can make a huge increase in efficiency in our power infrastructure.
So this would be amazingly useful on Tatooine or something like that.
Oh, yeah. So I mean, I think if all of the safety issues and the technical issues all work out, this all pans out, and everyone's happy that this is a viable technology, I think this is the kind of thing that could potentially go into huge usage in the future and go a long way to solving a lot of our energy issues.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see. This may be the flying car of the future where it's always 10, 20 years away and we never see it. But I can't see any fundamental reason why this would not work. A couple of quick updates. We talked a few weeks ago about the Chandrayaan-1 lunar probe. This is India's first unmanned spacecraft mission to the moon. And just a quick update, it has successfully entered lunar orbit.
Cool.
Awesome.
So far this mission is a success. The way they were getting this probe to the moon is really neat. They put it into Earth orbit, and then they swung it around the Earth multiple times, each time swinging farther out, you know, towards the moon, then coming back and looping back around the Earth and going a little bit farther out. So building up its orbit away from the Earth by borrowing from the Earth's gravity. And now it got out to the moon and was able to insert itself into lunar orbit. So it will now be there for quite some time, actually, taking pictures and preparing the way for possible future moon missions.
Did it borrow from Earth's gravity?
Well, it stole it.
Or angular momentum, or how does that work?
No matter how you slice it, if it's accelerating, if it's getting a gravity boost, that has to come from the Earth.
Right.
But it's so insignificant that it's probably,
I know, I'm just
measurable.
Trying to think if gravity is the way to phrase that, or is it angular momentum or something else.
Yeah, but it's because of gravity, right? That it's it's borrowing the you're probably right. It's better to say it's borrowing angular momentum but because of its gravitational interaction with the Earth. Actually, I'm inserting a quick update on November 15th, after the primary recording of this episode, because there was an update on the Chandrayaan mission. On November 14th, it successfully landed the Moon Impact Probe portion of Chandrayaan 1 at the south pole of the lunar surface. This is a part of the probe that is designed to, again, impact with the moon directly. It contains a radar altimeter, a video imaging system, and a mass spectrometer, and it is a way of exploring possible future landing sites on the moon. The Moon Impact Probe is one of 11 other scientific instruments or payloads on the Chandrayaan-1, so this is just part of its mission. Another quick follow-up. This one is a little sad. The Phoenix lander has finally gone quiet.
Oh, that sucks.
Oh, that's a little sad.
It is sad.
As we talked about with Diana Blaney a couple weeks ago, the Phoenix lander was slowly running out of energy as the Martian sun, you know, was dipping closer to the horizon, and the solar panels were getting less and less sunlight. NASA announced earlier this week that they've ceased receiving any kind of radio communication from the lander, and now it is officially completely shut down, and they do not think that it will ever reactivate. So
there is a tiny chance that in 2 years, whatever ice it has become encased in or whatever will it be encased in ice? It would, right?
It'll probably frost, yeah.
Yeah, so because the seasons there apparently last twice as long as they last on Earth, so In about a year, the Martian summer should be beginning, and then after a bit of time after that, hopefully it could possibly thaw out and then start working again.
They got 5 months out of it, which is very good.
More than they thought they'd get.
It's more than they thought they'd get. Yeah.
Right. But they
guess I'm just a hopeless optimist.
It is. There's a sliver of possibility, but they're not counting on it. But the project itself is officially.
I just think that's so sad. Like you can just picture it, kind of like, you know, the arm just kind of moved and then no more. You know,
days.
It's a lonely, days. Cold place on the North Pole of Mars.
Some future alien race will find it,
or current alien race. Yeah.
The shadows will find it. they have a base on Mars.
And the Bigfoot.
The shadows. What kind of nerd reference is that?
Babylon 5.
Babylon 5. Oh, they were the coolest bad guys.
They were. They were awesome. One more news item. This is part of our series on how pseudoscience or superstition kills. And this is an incredibly, you know, upsetting and sad story, as they all are. This one coming from Nigeria.
Heartbreaking. What's happening in Nigeria and what happens in a lot of African countries is that children are being driven out of their homes or outright murdered and being accused of being witches or devils or what have you by local religious, mostly Christian, you know, insane people.
Well, they're priests. The local sect is like this combination of Christianity and traditional superstitions or traditional beliefs, including witches. So it's basically it's in that way it's very similar to a lot of the like Caribbean voodoo cults, where it's amalgamation of Christianity and the traditional local belief systems or legends.
There's an extra level of nefariousness to it in that these local religious leaders charge these families months' worth of their wages. I mean, they live on a few dollars a month, and they save up months' worth of money, and they give it to these religious leaders. They then come over and perform their exorcism to try to ward out the demons from the child, and then when it's determined that they can't do it, then the children are either killed or tortured or released into the streets. And mm-hmm. it's really is just about as tragic a story as you can possibly read.
You said it was happening in many countries, but are you sure it's not just confined to, for the most part, to Nigeria?
No,
I haven't heard of any other cases.
I read about Angola, and I also read about Niger, and I read about the Congo. It seems to be, and these
it's
are stories
regional.
Actually that go back many, many years. There have been many, many reports of these. They said it's been on the rise for the last decade, basically.
What's interesting is that the parallels with the medieval witch hunts and that these children are being accused of witchcraft. Mm-hmm. When anything bad happens, you know, someone gets sick and dies or whatever, anything bad happens, then the local priest says, oh, that's because the child is practicing witchcraft. They've been possessed by a demon. Now they're going to cast spells and they can contaminate others. And this has become an industry in a very much a similar way that the witch hunters were in medieval times, you know, in the medieval witch hunts in Europe. They charge for the exorcism, and then they're making quite a lucrative living off of it. They're living in large homes, driving around in expensive cars. They're living high off the hog, essentially scaring, you know, the locals into giving them, as you say, many months, sometimes up to a year's worth of their salary. And then, I mean, think of how heartless you have to be making money off of the suffering of little children. The stories here, I mean, to me, they're almost unbelievable, where you have a parent kicking a five-year-old girl out into the street to fend for herself. To me, that is unimaginable. And it's hard for me to get into the mind of somebody who could possibly do that. Either they simply do not have the bond with their child that, say, I have with mine, or that their fear and superstition is so overwhelming that they just must be insane or beside themselves that they could possibly do that. It's hard for me.
There's one paragraph in here that I have to read this paragraph from the article because it just sums up the whole thing. It says, during the deliverance ceremonies, the children are shaken violently, dragged around the room, and have potions poured into their eyes. The children look terrified. The parents look on, praying that the child will be cleansed. If the ritual fails, they know their children will have to be sent away or killed. Many are held in churches, often on chains, and deprived of food until they confess to being a witch.
Holy
crap. How about that?
It's medieval.
It's even worse than what was happening in medieval.
Yeah,
Europe.
It really is. Yeah.
And it's the other parallel is that they're going after a vulnerable population. Again, in medieval Europe, it was women, and now it's children, which are even more vulnerable. It's just unbelievably barbaric.
It's not isolated incidents either. It really is. It's thousands of children that have suffered. Due to this, and the more attention it gets in other parts of the world, certainly, I guess the better. For if there's anything better to come out of this, but really, it's almost sickening to have to read this.
That's the new winner for the most heinous manifestation of paranormal belief. I mean, what the hell is worse than that?
We get emails from people quite often where they're. You know, they'll say, well, you know, what's the harm in somebody believing in this if it makes them happy or whatever? And these are the things that this is the answer. This is what the problem is because sometimes small, silly beliefs turn into big, dangerous beliefs. And this is a prime example of something that's gone just so far out of control, and it's so unbelievably abusive that you can't make an excuse for it. You can't just say, yeah, okay, well, this, you know, this is their religion, or this is the, you know.
No, it's just evil. Now we're just into yep. evil territory, you know. Well, let's go on to our interview. We are joined now by Dr. Paul Offit. Paul, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
And Dr. Offit is a pediatrician and the author of Autism's False Prophets, Bad Medicine, Risky Business, and the Search for a Cure, which is all about various pseudosciences involved with autism treatment. So, Paul, quick, give us an overview of the book and how you got involved with this topic of autism.
Well, I guess I got involved because my expertise is in the area of vaccines and vaccine safety, and certainly vaccines have been targeted, I think, by some groups as being the cause of autism. I guess where I got in, where I got passionately involved in this is that I think, you know, historically in medicine, when there is not a clear cause or cure for a disorder or disease, you'll see people step up and say, look, although mainstream medicine doesn't know what's going on, I know what's going on. I know the cause. I know the cure. And I think that's what's happened here. People like Andrew Wakefield or Jenny McCarthy are perfectly willing to step up in front of the public and say, you know, trust me, I can make your child better. And I think it's unfair. I think it takes unfair advantage of children with autism and their parents who are desperate to do something that can quickly make their child better. And I think it's charlatanism and quackery, and it's just not fair.
So they're a vulnerable population because it's a disorder for which there isn't a clear cause or etiology, and nor are there cures. I mean, there are obviously treatments that could make them better, but nothing that's a game changer in terms of the outcome.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, when you know, children certainly are severely autistic and it's emotionally draining or financially draining for the family, it's very seductive to think that you can give a shot of vitamin B12 or you know, give an oral antifungal medication and have it all go away. But it's because, you know, in many ways, the wheels of science here do turn slowly, but they are turning. I think, you know, many exciting things are being discovered, but you know, obviously a treatment or a cure is not just around the corner. And I think, you know, this seductiveness of just giving a medicine that makes it all go away, I think is what is so attractive to parents. But it's ultimately, I think it really hurts children with autism. It diverts resources away from far more promising leads. It puts children in the way of some dangerous and potentially fatal medicines. And I think it's meant children haven't gotten vaccines, and that's led to outbreaks.
And yet, in my experience, the mainstream, you know, medical establishment and even the regulatory agencies that are involved don't seem quite know how to deal with this phenomenon of pseudoscience or charlatanism in the field of autism. Do you agree with that? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I do agree with it. I think people who are autism experts or infectious disease experts, I mean, scientists, are. I think that what it takes to perform good science and write about good science and speak about science in the scientific venue is very different from, I think, the skills that are required to speak to the media or speak to the public about science and how it works. And it's certainly not a natural act. It's very difficult, I think, to speak to the media and try and condense very complex issues into simple terms. It's certainly nothing that you're taught. And I think also, you know, scientists tend to be a group that is, you know, that prefers to sort of be a laboratory and not necessarily, you know, go out there and speak to a large audience, and it's intimidating.
And yet you got involved with that. So do you think that it's just because you had the extra skill set necessary to communicate this to the public, or is it just more of you had the drive?
Yeah, I think I had the drive. I certainly didn't have the skill set. I think I've learned to some extent how to deal with the media better as time's gone on, but I certainly didn't have it to start. It was, if anything, to the degree I've acquired the skill, it was an acquired skill, and it was the passion. I mean, you know, I lived through, you know, the measles epidemic in Philadelphia in 1991, where Nine children died of measles, and hundreds were hospitalized. And many of these parents had chosen not to vaccinate their children. It's extremely difficult to watch a child come into your hospital, get measles pneumonia, and die from measles. And all you can do is try and provide support, you know, with ventilation and oxygenation. But that's it. There's no medicine to make measles go away. The only thing to do is to prevent it. And you know, medicine is so limited in general that when you do have something that can work and work safely, such as a measles vaccine, and to have someone not give it because they're making just a bad decision based on bad information, it's just very hard to watch. I mean, this is the same thing that drove me to go into pediatrics or drove me to work on a rotavirus vaccine, I guess, drives me here.
You know, I'm a physician who does the same kind of thing in terms of trying to educate the public about pseudoscience and medicine. And what I have a hard time really getting is why more physicians don't have the same passion. Why aren't they bothered as much as you and I are about this pseudoscience? You've outlined, I think, very well all the harm that is done. I think they would be more passionate about it.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. First of all, you know, the media typically covers stories, even such as the vaccine autism story, as if it's a medical or scientific controversy. And using the journalistic mantra of balance, both sides have to be represented, even though the science, frankly, only supports one side. And so it's very frustrating. I mean, you know, your voice becomes just one voice on one side, and there's, you know, just you find it very difficult to convince journalists that, you know, this mantra of balance doesn't have to be followed. It's perfectly reasonable to have perspective absent any science on the other side. And so what it becomes, I think, in many ways, is an anti-science story, which is there's the groups, you know, like me or you, who sort of stand up for the science, and then there's the other side who largely don't believe in science or just see science as merely one opinion in a sea of opinions. And that's very frustrating for people. And I can see where, you know, people would be reluctant to enter this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, and you say the media has this sort of false balance that they apply to these issues when they should be giving perspective. But even when they do have a physician or somebody from the CDC or a similar agency on, they typically do a terrible job. It seems like the CDC especially has, I think, just doesn't get it. I don't think they understand how to communicate this issue effectively to the public. They're so afraid, it seems to me, of overstating an issue that they equivocate when they don't need to, and it just becomes more fodder for the other side.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think there's sort of two reasons for that. I think one, and both legitimate. I think on the one hand, you know, we are, I think our country sort of founded on the base of individual rights and freedoms is extremely open-minded to sort of all attitudes and beliefs, and it just feels wrong to say to somebody who believes, in this case, that vaccines cause autism, that they're just not right. And however, science, although I think very open-minded, is not terribly politically correct. You know, when you're wrong, you're wrong. Although I can see where people feel that they're denying someone a legitimate attitude merely by the fact that they have it, by saying, you know, that it's not true. The other thing I think is that the scientific method, you know, you can never prove never. I mean, you can never prove statistically that something is statistically impossible. We all know that in the back of our heads. So we know that we really are not allowed to say things like MMR doesn't cause autism. And so we sound equivocal. We say all the evidence to date does not support the hypothesis that MMR, you know, causes autism. And to parents who certainly, you know, see or read about autism far more than they see measles, they hear a door being left open. And so, you know, to them, it's still a case that's not resolved. And you know, if given my druthers, then I'll choose not to get the vaccine since I don't see measles, but I see autism.
Now, your book covers more than just vaccines, but I do want to focus on that a little bit. First of all, why do you think there is this persistent anti-vaccinationist movement? It's really almost a cult or a religion. What is it that sticks in certain people's craws about vaccines that inspires so much fervor on the other side, do you think?
Well, I think the anti-vaccine movement has really been around since the first vaccine. You can find, you know, pictures by cartoonists, you know, in the early 1800s, you know, where people are getting smallpox vaccine and taking on characteristics of cows, you know, the smallpox vaccine being derived from a cow virus. And so, you know, myths or misunderstanding about vaccines are 2 centuries old. And I think at its heart, you know, it's something given to healthy people. It's something injected into them. It's something the fluid itself is a biological that I think by many is poorly understood. All that in combination with you know public health requirements that often mandate vaccines, you know, makes people uncomfortable. I think what's changed in the past say 10 years is. Degree to which those who have, frankly, ill-conceived notions about vaccines or just false notions about vaccines have been given legitimacy by the media. I mean, the fact that somebody like Jenny McCarthy can get on CNN and be interviewed by responsible journalists as if, you know, her opinion about the cause or causes of autism were valid merely because she has an autistic child is a little frightening. I mean, you know, I think a seminal moment for me on television is probably the worst moment on television, I think, in this story, is when Larry King had on his show Jenny McCarthy, Holly Robinson Pete, and a mother of a child with autism, and went around the table and asked them, you know, what do you think causes autism? And what do you think causes autism? And, you know, you're thinking, where's the autism expert? Isn't this the person you should be asking? But no.
And, you know, we've talked about this issue on this podcast before, but just to summarize, there are those like Jenny McCarthy, as you say, and a lot of organizations like Defeat Autism Now, for example, is one, that are dedicated to this notion that either vaccines themselves or mercury in vaccines is associated with autism. But there has been, what, like 16 studies now to date internationally and in the United States showing a lack of a correlation between vaccines and autism. And yet they're not giving up. But this was sparked primarily by Andrew Wakefield, who you mentioned earlier, who was a British doctor who claimed, based upon a very small and, in retrospect, fatally flawed study, that there's a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Wakefield, I mean, in your book, and I think this is completely accurate, you certainly make him out to be one of the villains of this story. Looking back on this now, what do you think was motivating Wakefield from the beginning, or how did he end up in the role that he is in?
I think Andrew Wakefield believes that MMR caused autism. I think that if you gave him I don't know Andrew Wakefield well, I'm guessing, but I don't think he's lying. I think if you gave him a lie detector test and said now that we have 10 studies, 10 large epidemiological studies looking at hundreds of thousands of children that did or didn't get MMR vaccine to find that the risk of autism is no different between those two groups, and we found that your initial hypothesis that measles-containing vaccine, you know, persistently replicates in the intestine and causes chronic inflammation, that now too has been disproved, I still think he would say, but I know this to be true. I mean, he holds on to this like a religious belief, and I think he has a following that is much like a religious following. And I think in some ways you can understand it. I mean, you know, science is what I think I love about science is its mutability. You know, that a paper can be published by a very good researcher in a very good journal and be dead wrong, and yet, you know, and it will fail to meet the test of reproducibility, and therefore it will be wrong. But to some people, that fluidity, I think, is seen as uncomfortable, and they find solace in somebody like Andrew Wakefield, who stands up and says, look, I know what's going on. I absolutely know this to be true. It doesn't matter what they're saying. I know this to be true, and I can heal your child. I think that, is, for some, is very attractive.
Certainly, he has, you know, a lot invested in this notion, and it would be a remarkable admission if he said, you know, it turns out I was wrong. You know, 10 years later, the evidence has had a chance to work its way through, you know, the scientific meat grinder, and it turns out it's not true. I mean, some scientists can do that, but he cannot. I mean, I guess he's just far, far too invested emotionally in his persona, his career. But it makes you wonder, did he start out as a crank, or was he really a good scientist that just became overwhelmed by the emotion of this issue?
Well, I think if you look at the quality of the papers that he's published, it's really hard to make an argument that he's a good scientist. I think he's convincing because he's convinced. And if you watch him on, for example, on a 60-minute show where Ed Bradley was the interviewer, and he asked him the question, do you think MMR causes autism? I mean, he sort of leaned forward toward the camera, very calm, very certain. Yes, I certainly do think it causes it. I mean, would you give it to your children? No, I would not. I would separate it into its three component parts, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine separately. Where he gets this from, I don't know. I mean, he sort of made it up, but it was the birth of the notion that separating the vaccines would in some way lessen your risk of autism, which is obviously fanciful and ill-founded. But he's convincing because he's convinced. I think that's what makes him so powerful in many ways. And you know, ultimately, he's been essentially thrown out of England. He can't practice in England anymore. He's settled into Thoughtful House in Austin, Texas, where he and his staff have cures for children with autism. It's all very sad, but I think in this country we're particularly tolerant of that brand of quackery.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the lone sort of clinician in their own clinic who has this revolutionary treatment that is not accepted by the closed-minded mainstream community, that is a story that the public relates to.
Exactly. I mean, we love medical mavericks. We love mavericks, period, but medical mavericks especially. And you know, here's a guy who says, and it's the medical establishment, right? Just the phrase itself just seems very staid and unwilling to accept new ideas. But here's a guy who's going to sort of throw it all aside and cure your children. I think the subtext is he's the guy who really cares. I mean, he's, as compared to all these other doctors who are throwing their hands up and saying, we don't have a clear cause and we don't have a clear cure. Here's a guy that shows he cares by having a cure. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that when you, for example, have restrictive diets that don't include casein, you know, you put yourself at risk of not getting enough calcium and therefore having thinning of the bones, which has clearly been shown in a study that was done in combination with Children's Hospital in Cincinnati and the NIH. Or when you choose to get chelation therapy, you can you know, critically lower your body stores of calcium and cause your heart to stop beating, as was shown by the fatal case of a child in suburban Pittsburgh who got injected with a chelation medicine and died. So, you know, in the name of helping, I think ultimately he hurts.
Now, you outline in the book that you've personally come under tremendous attack for simply trying to explain the scientific evidence to the public. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, because I and some others also, you know, stand up and say it's not vaccines, I think that's perceived by some as just simply representing, you know, that medical establishment or the pharmaceutical company establishment that is just simply trying to hurt children. Obviously, it's not a correct notion. But I would say this. I mean, just in fairness, when I published this book, I assumed that my hate mail would only increase. But actually, that didn't happen. I mean, if anything, it's decreased. And I would say every day I get between 5 and 10 emails from parents of children with autism who love the book, I mean, who completely agree with the point of view of the book, who felt are angry at people like Jenny McCarthy, who they feel don't represent them, and are I think if the book has in some ways has given them cover to sort of come out and say, you know, we never thought vaccines was this, and we're a little angry that there was frankly a smaller group of parents who were standing up and choosing to represent or presuming to represent us when they don't represent us. It's actually been the opposite of what I would have predicted.
Why do you think that is? I mean, certainly you have been, you're number one on the hit list for the anti-vaccinationists or the Mercury Militia, as we call them. And I agree with you that, and I've heard from a lot of them as well, parents of autistic children who don't believe that it's the vaccines and think that the whole thing is a travesty. So, and I do think that we're maybe seeing a little bit of a backlash against the Jenny McCarthys. But I am a bit surprised. I mean, I thought that you already were in the crosshairs that this book would just up the ante a little bit, but I guess it hasn't. Do you think it's deflected some of the anger against you?
Maybe it has. I tell you, I'm surprised certainly by the positive email. I mean, I guess rationalize or explain it by saying that the book provided cover or at least a focus for people who I think now see the story a little more clearly and it felt right to them that vaccines weren't it. But I have no explanation for why there's been a decrease in the hate mail. I mean, I still get, you know, on a weekly basis something pretty negative and the occasional calls to my office, but it's definitely decreased. I don't have an explanation for that. Maybe they're just so angry at me they just can't say anything anymore.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. But you've had actual death threats, right?
Yeah.
Or physical threats.
Well, I had physical threat and death threat. And I think the scariest one was sort of an implied threat to my children, which obviously is just intolerable and was the first time, frankly, only time I ever really considered stopping doing this. But that I think that's largely decreased. I honestly don't believe. I really think, although there are a small group of people, fringe people, who I don't in no way, I think, represent in any way near sort of most parents with autism, I really don't believe they would hurt me. I just don't think. I think they're frustrated and angry, and I'm a focus of that anger, but I just can't believe that they would actually really ever hurt me.
Although I do think the very deliberate point of all of it is intimidation. And as you say, it almost worked. I mean, it's almost even somebody as passionate as you would come to the conclusion that, well, maybe it's just not all worth it.
Well, it's easy to see how one could come to that conclusion. I mean, I think people imagine that I because I'm the co-inventor and co-patent holder of vaccine, that somehow I have a financial stake in this. I have no financial stake in this. I mean, you know, our hospital sold out its patent months ago, and so it doesn't matter to me whether vaccine sold or not. I do it because I think it's the right thing to do. But I think, I mean, it does work. I mean, intimidation works. You take somebody like, you know, Sarah Parker, who I discuss in the book, who, you know, who's a superb researcher and was very much interested in vaccine safety and wrote an excellent sort of paper describing the epidemiological studies that were done by people like Mark and David Geyer compared to studies that were obviously far better done to show the weaknesses in the Geyer's paper. And when she did that, and with, you know, people like Larry Pickering and Ben Schwartz and Jim Todd, they got, you know, aside from getting sued, they also got, she especially was really harassed with phone calls and letters. She had a young child. And ultimately said, it's not worth it. I'm getting out. So I think intimidation does work. I certainly learned a lot more about what you can and can't say to someone on the phone than I ever would have liked to have learned in my discussions now with the police. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's science by thuggery in many ways. And even Jenny McCarthy, I mean, she gets on those shows and she shouts down the scientists that she's sitting across from. I mean, that's, they think that they just need to shout louder than everybody else.
And the shows let it happen. And it's pretty pathetic, isn't it? I mean, Well, and I remember the show, at least one show, with Harvey Karp and David Taylor, who was the president elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics, that Larry King lets her sit there and scream at these excellent physicians who are there only because they care and are trying to get the science right. I mean, shows how silly this has become. I mean, it's like a step above mud wrestling as an entertainment sport.
Good for the ratings. Unfortunately, yeah. There was one, for me, someone who's involved with this issue, there was one curious omission in the book, and I assume this is just because of timing, but you didn't discuss the mitochondrial issue that's cropped up over the last year, the notion that maybe the combination of an underlying mitochondrial disorder and a trigger like mercury may be causing autism. Did that just come too late to make it into this book?
Right. It came exactly right. It came too late to make it. We were already sort of at late galley proof stage, and it was just, you know, the pages were kind of set. It was very hard to add that in. Impossible, really.
Might there be another edition where that would be added?
Yeah, I think if the book, and it will go to paperback because it's actually sold fairly well. I think we'll add that in. I mean, that was an unfortunate episode. You know, the Department of Health and Human Services, as sort of part one of this vaccine injury compensation program, decided to concede a case of a young girl, a 9-year-old, whose parents claimed that when she was about a year and a half of age, she had received several vaccines at once, and those vaccines had contributed to her autism. It was conceded because the federal government saw this as what's called a table injury, which is that when children who have an underlying encephalopathy, which means sort of brain dysfunction, associated with a known defect, in this case it was presumably a mitochondrial enzyme defect, and mitochondria are just, you know, the parts of the cells that help convert nutrients to energy, that when what they thought they were settling is that measles-containing vaccine can worsen an encephalopathy in children, you know, like this girl. And unfortunately, her symptoms included sort of signs and symptoms consistent with autism. But, you know, that's probably not autism. You know, when children have severe cognitive deficits, like children with Down syndrome, for example, they're going to have problems with, you know, speech or language or communication or behavior. They may meet some of the criteria for autism, but that really isn't classic autism. And that's never what they thought they were settling. But the parents, you know, and the parents' lawyer and people like David Kirby made a big media deal of this. And so where the, you know, the government basically said nothing, which was hard to watch.
Yeah, and the father of the girl happens to be a neurologist, although I think he was in residency or fellowship or something at this time, sort of a young neurologist just getting started. And he is starting to go down the rabbit hole. I mean, it was really painful to watch this guy, you know, obviously because he has a very personal involvement with this issue, start to buy into the anti-vaccinationist pseudoscience bit by bit. And then he started actually challenging me directly when I was discussing this issue on my blog and in other venues. Really just incredible. And how does somebody who's trained as a scientist and as a physician start to completely get overwhelmed by this pseudoscience? It's incredible.
Yeah, it's hard to watch, but it shows you that to some extent no one's invulnerable, that sort of driven by anecdotes and not necessarily good logical or critical thinking, some people go down the rabbit hole, and I guess no one is immune, including people who are trained as neurologists.
Right, right. And as you say, I mean, just for the conclusion, there is no reason to conclude based upon this one quirky case that there's any correlation between, you know, mitochondrial disorders and vaccines and autism. And as you said, the girl didn't have autism. She had some autism-like symptoms triggered by an encephalopathy or caused by an encephalopathy. So it really has no bearing on the case, but, you know, David Kirby and others completely spun out of nothing but total speculation an entire new theory of how vaccines could be related to autism, since the Mercury one is crashing and burning, which, again, makes us think that it's all about the vaccines. Again, it always comes back to whatever the theory is, it has to be somehow tied to vaccines. That seems to be their focal point.
Right, and I think probably the biggest frustration for me in this is the degree to which autism experts do not stand up to the media and the public and explain this. I mean, I went to a talk this morning by Bob Schultz, who's the head of the Center for AIDS Research. I'm sorry, I'm an infectious disease person, so I always see CFAR as AIDS. He's the head of the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he gave a wonderful talk, you know, describing how children with autism share basically an inability to judge their environment and people in their environment as people, as personalities, and are much more sort of likely to just see them in a systematic way rather than an empathetic way. And then he sort of showed how he could using this functional MRI studies, trace that to particular areas of the brain, like, you know, the fusiform gyrus or the amygdala. I mean, it's really beautiful studies. And then he goes on to describe what he sees as the genetic basis of autism and how those genes make proteins that explain a lot of what he sees. It was a great talk. I mean, it lasted an hour. We never said the word vaccines. And I'm thinking, why isn't he the one who's talking to the media about this? Why isn't an infectious disease specialist or a gastroenterologist like Andrew Wakefield talking to the media about this? And it's just, it's very frustrating because I think autism it can be much better defined for the public than it is. I mean, the fact that my wife, who's a pediatrician, sees children with Down syndrome and autism, you know, is I think a misuse of the word. And I think the mitochondrial enzyme case is a perfect example of that. I mean, if she has a severe encephalopathy associated with the mitochondrial enzyme defect, it's not surprising at all that the child would also have, you know, symptoms that would consist of, that would be some symptoms that would also be included in the autism spectrum. But that's really not autism. And so I just found the whole thing very frustrating. But frustrating that they don't stand up. I mean, that they don't stand up to define this and to talk about the really good science that's going on out there.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of brings us back to what we started talking about, that it's almost like there's these two completely separate worlds going on out there. There's the world of legitimate autism research that is making steady progress in, you know, elucidating the genetic basis of autism and the functional basis of it and what really, you know, makes autism autism. And this other world in the media and the anti-vaccinationists and the cranks that is focusing on completely irrelevant issues and are utterly dismissive of this vast body of scientific research that is showing, you know, again, mainly that there's a large genetic contribution to autism. You know, these two worlds are not connecting, and that where the media is connecting to the wrong one. They're not showcasing the actual science that's happening, which is stunning in many ways.
Yeah, and maybe it's just because it's too boring. I mean, I certainly every time I talk to the media and they say so, I mean, nothing's known about the cause of cause. I say it's not true. I mean, there's an issue of Science recently. It was in July of 2008 where, you know, Jim Sutcliffe from Vanderbilt went through, it was called New Insights into the Pathogenesis of Autism, and he sort of went through the genetics of autism, what proteins those genes make, and how now there's a lot of excitement about looking at this so-called synapse, which is, you know, the area where one brain cell communicates with another, and the proteins involved in that stuff. It's all very interesting stuff. And, you know, you talk to them, but, you know, there's nothing controversial about that, and it's hard to sort of put a personality to that. I mean, you're not going to have the celebrity that's going to talk about that. I mean, you know, people like David Kirby or Jenny McCarthy are very interesting to the media, and it's unfortunate because I think the way that this story is covered has only caused misperceptions to be perpetuated, and I think the media just has done a really intellectually lazy job of covering this story.
I agree. Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking with us, and your book is Autism's False Prophets. Again, it goes into more than just the vaccine controversy, all sorts of fake cures over the years for autism. You know, I definitely appreciate the work that you're doing. I hope you'll keep doing it. I won't get either intimidated or tired, because we need the few voices that we have trying to stand up for science and reason and medicine.
Thank you, Steve.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Everyone ready for this week?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that eliminating sugary sodas from high schools significantly reduced obesity levels over a two-year period. Item number two, a new study finds that the majority of commercial television stations are providing the bare minimum of mandated educational/informational programming for children, and much of that is minimally educational. And item number three, the UK is suffering a critical shortage of sperm donation.
Where the hell do you find these things?
Bob, go first.
I shouldn't have said anything. Da, 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 da. So taking away sugary sodas from high school significantly reduced obesity levels over a two-year period. I'm not buying that. I mean, they're going to get their sugary drink somewhere. I think it might have an impact, but significantly reducing obesity levels? That seems a little much.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Okay, hold your comments till it's your turn.
Let's see. I got to read this one. A new study finds that the majority of commercial television stations are providing the bare minimum of mandated. That sounds right. And three, the UK is suffering a critical shortage of sperm donation. Why does that ring a bell? Not that I read it recently,
ding.
But some other. Yeah, I don't think they masturbate much over there. So I'm gonna go with number one. I think the soda one doesn't sound quite right.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I agree with Bob's reasoning that, you know, kids are going to be fat if they're going to be fat. They'll get their sugary drinks outside school if they need to. I don't think it's good to have sodas in the schools because they get to advertise and stuff, and I'm a crazy hippie, so I don't think that's right. But still, that seems false. The idea that the majority of commercial television stations are providing the bare minimum of educational information for children, that just seems so obvious that it makes me suspect that you made it up. But, you know, I haven't actually seen commercial television in a long time. So, but that certainly makes sense. And the UK suffering a shortage of sperm donation, I almost feel like you threw that in just to mess with me so that I could make a sperm joke.
Or a UK joke.
Or a sperm from the UK joke. I mean, obviously they must be suffering a critical shortage because Americans are taking all of the sexy British men. so that seems right. So I'll go with number one being the false one. I'm with Bob.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, that's the problem here, though, is that the sugary soda one seems like the obvious fiction here. But I get concerned when that's the case, because I don't think that's necessarily the case. But the other two just seem too plausible. I'll agree with my cohorts, and I'll also say that the obesity level with the sugary sodas, that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, I want to disagree with everyone just to not agree with everyone.
Good tactic.
Yeah, it works for me.
Works 33% of the time.
All right, so there's something about the third one, about the UK suffering a critical shortage of sperm donation. That's just not feeling right to me.
Oh.
So, Evan, I'm going to say that one's the fake.
So it's just not hitting you right.
Yeah.
It's more like a fake.
Despite my personal observation that it's probably true.
Oh.
Well, you all agree that a new study finds that the majority of commercial television stations are providing the bare minimum of mandated educational informational programming for children, and much of that is minimally educational. You all think that that one is true.
Yeah.
And that one is science.
Yay.
That's the obvious one that, you know, sometimes, you know, you might be tricked into thinking that the obvious one is.
I was really hoping that was fiction. I mean, that would
be. That's true, unfortunately. And so this is a new study that looked at, you know, a broad survey of television, of shows that are on television. This is presented at a news conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., a study performed by Barbara Wilson, who's a professor of communication. And she found that 59% of commercial stations are meeting the minimum 3 hours per week that's mandated. And that only 3% of stations are offering more than 4 hours. So basically, they're almost all providing at or near the bare minimum that they're mandated to provide. She also found that only 13% of those programs were rated as highly educational. 23% were minimally educational, and the rest were moderately educational. Further, a third problem, if you break down the kinds of education that the shows are doing, and they break them down to social, emotional lessons versus cognitive, intellectual versus health, the vast majority are providing social, emotional lessons. Only a third are addressing academic lessons, and only 3% health lessons. They also did find that the majority of educational programming is on PBS, which is not a big surprise, is on public television, not commercial television. I mean, this brings up the issue of, you know, how much is it the responsibility of commercial television to, you know, be educating our youth? They must feel that it is not commercially
viable,
that it's not commercially lucrative, because they're certainly making an effort to absolutely minimize the amount that they're presenting, which leads you to believe that if they were not mandated, they probably would providing almost none.
Right.
Well, it's just like everything where we complain about the media not giving the skeptical point of view its due. It's the exact same thing where they've found an easy formula where, like, Paris Hilton equals ratings somehow, probably because there actually is a Satan. They're not willing to actually take risks and give us intelligent programming for adults or children. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think it's just the ultimate dilemma is, in a free market of mass media, it's going to cater to the lowest common denominator. There seems to be this trend towards decreasing quality and, you know, increasing sensationalism and drama and whatnot. You saw this happen over the last 30 years or so in daytime, you know, talk television, starting out with something closer to Donahue and ending up with Jerry Springer, which is now, like, Jerry Springer's name is almost synonymous with trashy daytime television.
And Oprah.
And good Cleveland politics.
Right.
I've only got one thing to say about that.
Yeah.
That's two things,
okay, that
Jay.
Made me laugh.
Right. I also think I don't think it's impossible to make entertaining programming that also happens to fulfill some sort of social goal of being educational or informational.
And you can find good educational stuff on TV, on a lot of the cable networks. You got to look. You got to pay attention. You got to do a little work.
Right.
Sid the Science Kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like, why isn't there always a Bill Nye the Science Guy-like show on? You know, if Bill can't do it, or, you know, he's moved on to something else, there should always be a kid's science show with a funny, entertaining person making that. There's no, you know, you look at the TV, and there's nothing there challenging the kids and making them think about anything. You know, if it's not coming from their parents, it's actually not coming from anywhere then.
It actually is there, but it's lost in a wash of crud, right? So you have to be able to filter it out, and it takes time and effort to do that. A lot of parents and other people don't want to spend the time. They're, you know, what they consider leisure time. Doing that, but I do pay attention to those sorts of things.
Right. What's also different now than, say, when we were kids Yeah, when we were kids, there were cartoons on television in very prescribed times. Saturday morning cartoons was a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, they had TV when you were kids? Right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I thought you guys just looked at those shit.
You sat around the radio?
Yeah, they had hardwired internet connections, too.
Yeah, I thought you guys just listened to Little Orphan Annie with your decoder rings. And
we listened to The Shadow on the radio. Gather
Frank
around,
Ovaltine.
Children.
The Shadow knew.
But now there's 24-hour cartoon networks, multiple, you know, kids. They could get 24/7 cartoons. It actually takes a little bit of an effort to, you know, change the channel away from the cartoon channel onto something educational. What I find is that for my daughters is that they will migrate to the cartoons naturally. But if I flip onto a science show, mm-hmm. they'll happily watch that,
yeah.
and they'll enjoy it. That's good, but that takes that modicum of effort on the part of the parent to find a good science program and then sit with your kids while watching it and help them understand how cool it is, you know, that whatever is happening on the show. Whether, you know, there are some obvious hooks, too. Dinosaur shows are always easy.
Oh, speaking of dinosaurs, I'm sorry I said archaeologist last week instead of paleontologist.
Yeah, you screwed up big time.
Oh, that wasn't good.
Oh. Do you know how many emails we got on that?
One, I think.
Oh, I don't even remember.
I think there were two.
Oh, two?
But still, I felt really awful about it.
Right. Well, you know, we're unscripted. Occasionally we screw up. So let's see. Jay, you think that the UK is suffering a critical shortage of sperm donation. You think that one is fiction, and that one is science. That
Cold
one is
blimey.
True. Uh-huh. Cold blimey.
Cold blimey, governor.
Oh, God.
And this is resulting from some changes in the regulation of sperm donation. Well, yeah, donation, but also how it's used. So the primary use for sperm donation in this context is as donor sperm for, you know, women who needed to get pregnant. There are about 4,000 patients a year that would like to have, you know, donated sperm for that purpose. But the UK passed some regulation recently limiting the number of pregnancies from a single donor, a single individual person, a single donor to 10. The reason they did this was to minimize the chance of people who are related but don't know it, you know, end up like marrying later on. If a single donor had hundreds of kids out there, you know, then that could create that possibility. So they limited it to 10. They also limit it to men under 40. And they force donors to register so that they could track it. So you can't be going to like different clinics and donating your sperm in different locations. So they think that those regulations have conspired to decrease the number of new donors. Some men want their anonymity. And when you do have a donor, they're limited to only 10 donations for pregnancy purposes. They calculate they need about 500 new donors per year, but they're only getting about 307. In 2006, they got 307. So they're,
so
you know,
sperm is about to be the UK's biggest import.
Apparently, I guess they're not importing sperm. Maybe
no?
that would
seems
be one
like
a
natural solution. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess it's tightly regulated, so they would have
move
to
move it off site. I mean, move it to India, you know?
Yeah.
Like, instead
or
of moving IT
yeah.
jobs or whatever.
Outsource it.
Or Connecticut, is that what you said?
Yeah.
I think they have some standards or something there.
Yeah, that's true. Well, but they are now thinking of either expanding the age or expanding the number that can be used from a single donor, maybe to 25. And they said, you know, the figure of 10 is not evidence-based. They just pulled it out of their butt.
Oh, good.
They said, oh, let's limit to...
they pulled it out of.
Let's say 10. You know, it's an arbitrary number. It wasn't the basis of any calculation that was done.
It was based on their homeopathic calculation.
Right.
10 is the magic number.
Bollocks.
Which means that a new study finds that eliminating sugary sodas from high schools significantly reduced obesity levels over a 2-year period is fiction. Is totally fiction.
Sweet.
In fact, there was a recent study published in the Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior, which showed that this was done in Maine. They compared several different schools, one of which banned soda from the school. The other three did not. They took no action. So they were the control schools. And over a two-year period, they found that there was no decrease in the consumption of sugary sodas, of soda. Not only did it not change weight, it didn't change their actual access to soda. Mm. They were just, as someone said, they're gonna, if they want it, they're going to find it. And they did. Even though these kind of programs are becoming increasingly popular, you know, like putting water or juices and things into the vending machines and removing the Coke and Pepsi, in, at least in this one survey, over a two-year period, it did not change the behavior of the kids. I guess it was just too little of an impact on their total access to this for it to have a significant effect.
Cool.
I think that the main problem with having them in there isn't the obesity. It's the fact that you're advertising for sodas in a public school. It's not really appropriate, personally speaking.
But it is good. I mean, I do think that public policy and government policy should be evidence-based. So it's rather than just doing it because it sounds like a good idea, it's good to actually look at it and say, what is the impact of this? So I'm a firm believer in evidence-based government. So this, these kind of studies are helpful.
Really? You?
Yeah.
Huh.
Absolutely.
I never would have thought.
I was going to say, what, the government of Fantasyland? Where do you live?
Yeah, I know. Right. You can always dream. You can always dream.
I know. You have to have the ideal utopia in your mind, and then, you know.
That's what you're working
towards. And then
towards.
Wake up, and then open your eyes and look around. But,
So, Jay, recently you were the only one to be correct, and this week, unfortunately, the only one to be wrong. But you were brave. What? You were brave. You just went against the grain.
Yeah, I'm not afraid to take a chance.
Yeah. It was reasonable.
You gave it your best shot. You blew your wad.
It seemed like a sticky proposition to me anyway.
Jay, you showed a lot of spunk.
Oh!
Kidding. He doesn't even know if he's coming or going.
All right, anyway, I have my quote. Here's my quote.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. It's from Bertrand Russell.
Is he from the UK?
He was a British philosopher,
a logician.
Does he do magic tricks with logic?
Jay, it's logitarian.
I'm starting over.
He was replete with logitudinosity.
Excuse me.
Nice.
Ready?
Perfectly cromulent profession.
I'm talking. Anyway, this is a quote from Bertrand Russell, British philosopher, a mathematician, a historian, among other things. And he said, "Man is a credulous animal and must believe something. In the absence of good grounds for belief, he will be satisfied with bad ones." Bertrand Russell!
I say.
That's a good quote this week, Jay.
Thank you, submitted by Sean Gill, a listener.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
Any relation to Vince Gill?
And I noticed today that I don't remember how many women I've quoted, but it's the vast majority of the quotes are from men. And I would, if anyone has any quotes from women, I'd love for them to send them in.
You should quote me.
Oh, okay. I will. Ready?
Yeah.
This is a quote from Rebecca Watson. And the quote is...
Hot pockets.
God, I love that.
Sounds like you're gargling on something there, Rebecca.
Oh, that actually cheered me right up. Thank you.
So please dig us. We're starting to claw our way back up the dig count. I don't know why our numbers got cleared, but we appreciate you.
They just pushed the reset button on everything?
On us, they did. So we appreciate you taking the time to dig us or vote for us on your local aggregator or
iTunes reviews.
Review on iTunes.
Zune, wherever you get us.
Yeah, wherever you
go. And you should join our forum, too. Our forum's been pretty hopping lately. They've been doing good stuff.
Join our forums. You know, we got several blogs that, we're putting out there. Neurologica, Science-Based Medicine, and the Rogues Gallery, where the Rogues themselves contribute.
And Skeptic, you know.
And listen to 5x5. Don't forget your 5x5 fix.
5x5, the companion podcast to The Skeptic's Guide. It's a short format, single issue, and completely clean and suitable for the classroom format for skeptical podcasting. So,
are you people taking notes out there? Write this down.
Thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks,
of course,
Doctor.
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.